There's pressure from all sides as the Seattle City Council prepares for a big vote this afternoon on the new Seattle police contract. It is the first one in what, 4 years, Hannah?
Nearly 4 years, yeah. Seattle police officers have been working without a contract for that time and no raise. And that all happening as officers took on added workload, new rules, intense scrutiny because of the reforms under the DOJ consent decree. Not having a pay raise over the years as officers implement all of those changes mixed with the massive increase in the cost of living here has led to a big drop in morale, officers leaving the department much faster than the department can replace them, as well as problems hiring new cops with other local departments paying a lot more. Then last month, it was a celebration as the mayor and new SPD Chief Carmen Best announced there was a new contract with a big pay raise that's retroactive and, according to them, protected reforms and secured full implementation of body cameras, which was a big win. As the mayor said, the mayor said she had no reason to expect the city council would reject the contract. But just a couple of days later, a major roadblock as the Community Police Commission urged a no vote from the council, saying the new contract rolls back reforms.
We think it's a bad deal for Seattle. We are not trying to blow up the process, but we think that people need to come back to the table.
And then just last week, a coalition of 24 community groups came together to also urge a no vote by the council. And then later this morning, the NAACP local chapter is expected to do the same. The federal judge overseeing reforms under the consent decree found SPD in full compliance of those reforms. But at a hearing last week, to take a closer look at this contract, he said that compliance did not extend to the new contract, which came after he made that initial ruling of them being in compliance. And he also raised some concerns about police accountability under this contract, but he's not going to weigh in any further until the council votes one way or the other. After that, he could take some action. 7 of the 9 council members are going to have to approve this in order for it to pass. The Police Guild expected council members Shama Sawant and Mike O'Brien to be no votes and suggested a couple of weeks ago that Lisa Herbold was a no as well, but it's unclear if she may have changed her mind. It's something Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez has been working hard on.
I'm working really hard to make sure that all of the questions that my colleagues have are answered so that they feel comfortable voting yes.
And yesterday in West Seattle, Mayor Durkin reiterating to Cairo 7 that this contract does not roll back reforms.
I've been working on police reform for over 2 decades in this city. We lock in some really critical, important reforms and move reforms forward. We did it with agreement by the Police Officers Guild, and we're going to get our police officers paid.
Chief Carmen Best echoed that, and she also warned not approving this contract could have dire consequences and put public safety at risk.
But I believe that if this contract does not pass, we're going to lose more officers, and we're certainly not going to be able to add to the numbers that we have now.
So what is it in the contract? I don't understand what is in the contract
things,
that they're worried about.
Some of the issues being raised is that the language for a review standard for some disciplinary appeals is still a bit vague. There's also concerns that the other side will say that it makes it more difficult to discipline officers. But Chief Best, Mayor Durkin, and others on the pro side say that's not the case. There's also some language surrounding officers' off-duty work that they do and things of that nature. But there's no clear agreement. One side reads it as one way and the other side reads it another way.
But there's apparently some concern among the members of this Community Police Commission that officers could still basically misuse their weapons and not be held accountable for it?
It's that the standard language in this contract doesn't necessarily meet what the reform language does in their
I thought
opinion.
We just passed an initiative that pretty much lays out.
And 40 is a whole other deal, but I don't
well,
I think.
Why is it another deal? It applies to the Seattle Police Department, doesn't it? And it basically says that you take that malice standard out, so it makes it easier to discipline a cop who does the wrong thing, I thought. That would apply to everybody, contract or not, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but that's not what the consent decree reforms. The consent decree reform goes beyond that. It has to do with how officers treat people that they encounter on the street, various other things, racial bias, and all of that. So, the consent decree goes further than what I-940 does.
Okay. But I assume the contract wouldn't say racial bias is okay.
No,
right?
No, it does not say that. But it's just a few things that they think are not up to the standard. There's some ambiguity in the 180-day clock for completing internal investigations and some things of that nature. It's minor.
Complicated.
But yeah, it's complicated. But at any rate, so Chief Best, by the way, she sent a 2-page letter to the council yesterday promising that even if the contract is rejected, SPD officers would continue exceeding the requirements to the consent decree as they have. But she again really put out this dire warning, and she said it wasn't a scare tactic. we're going to lose a lot of cops if this is rejected. Plus, it could spark this big legal battle because under the contract, when it was agreed upon by the union, they removed the unfair labor practice complaints. There were several of them. Mm-hmm. If this is rejected, it's very likely that those would be filed or new ones would be filed, and it would just lead to this long legal battle. So there's warnings about that. So we'll see. They're voting at 2 this afternoon.
Is it fair to say everybody agrees that Seattle needs more cops?
Yes. I think Sean Massawant had a proposal a few weeks ago that would have cut back on cops.
But the rest of the council, I believe, because we keep comparing ourselves to Boston, we have like half the number of cops that Boston does. So it seems to me anything that results in less cops would be a really bad thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And there's business owners out on the street who say that they need more officers around. And the chief has said that. The mayor has said that. And we're going to lose them. Bellevue Police Department just offered a massive bonus. There are other departments in our area who are luring Seattle cops away, and there are many. Jason Rantz talks to a few over at KTTH who are just waiting to see how this goes, and they'll leave. Some of them already have applications out.
Yeah. Kyra's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke points. Let's go. Your twice a week prep talk from traffic coach Chris Sullivan, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. The state has made a teensy-weensy change in the entrance to the northbound I-5 express lanes, but that'll have a big impact on how that stretch of freeway operates. And to prepare you for this, here's Chris.
The state restriped the entrance to the northbound express lanes, adding a double white line for the final 1,600 feet before those express lanes begin. That means you can no longer get in and get out of that lane legally for the final quarter mile. That means no late diving in when the express lanes are open in the afternoon and no late diving out when they are closed like they are right now. Tom Pierce with the Washington Department of Transportation says the move was made to eliminate all the late weaving that causes unnecessary congestion.
We saw a lot of weaving in that area in the mornings when the express lanes were closed, with people trying to use that left lane and then jump over right away at the end. And then in the afternoon, we would see people bypassing the big line and then diving in at the last second. That created a lot of anger and frustration in drivers.
The problem with that late dive out in the morning is the next lane over is exit only to Seneca, which ends at about a quarter mile. So that doesn't give you much room to move over one more lane to get to a through lane. Cairo listener Mark Tiersma, though, hit me up the day this double white line went in, which was last Wednesday. He was concerned about this move and what it would mean for real life. He worried that this would simply move the congestion further south. He was concerned how this would impact merging and whether there would be any enforcement of double white line jumpers. So here is how the state would like it to work. Follow the signed prompts when the HOV lane ends and use the half mile that you have there of regular dotted line to merge to the right.
When you get to the end of the HOV lane, that's going to become a merge point. There will be signs warning that the express lanes are closed and that you'll need to move over to the right sometime before you get to the double white lines.
Now, I've driven through this a couple of times. I put a video up at mynorthwest.com. The express lane sign now actually has an X on it that shows you that lane is closed, kind of reinforcing the fact it's time to get over. Now, the reality, drivers who are backed up in that next lane over, the lane that will become the Seneca exit-only lane, well, they're going to have to let drivers merge in sooner than they are used to. So those drivers in the right lane need to play ball a little bit and let people merge.
The drivers really need to work together. The drivers on the right have got to slow down a little bit, make some gaps. The drivers from the left need to move over as soon as they get a gap. They can't be waiting until the last second. If you're waiting until the last second, that's where a lot of frustration comes from.
Eliminating the late weaving and merging should help the drive at the far north end on I-5, but it will likely cause more congestion a little bit further south. Drivers need to make their moves earlier and declare where they're going to be sooner. That means you got to get in the lane properly right
where you're
supposed
going.
To. Yeah. So hit me up on the Online Trading Academy text line 98973. Give me your thoughts on this change, whether you think it's going to work or whether that double white line really means nothing to you and you're willing to risk the $136 fine that could come with it.
And that exit only Seneca lane is going away too, right?
Yes. Well, not going away. What they're going to do is it's going to become a through lane. It's no longer going to be exit only.
So eventually you won't have to merge so much.
Right, exactly. Okay. We're going to use a little bit of the shoulder length there to get you under the convention center. That project is going to be started next spring.
More than 200 cities vied for the chance to be, like Seattle, home to one of the biggest businesses on the planet. HQ2 for Amazon. And now, instead of picking some little funky city, They decided on New York City and basically Washington, D.C., Crystal City, where the Pentagon is. Let's go to GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. So what does this mean exactly? This is HQ 2A, 2B, and then there's some kind of Nashville HQ 2C. What was this really all about then?
Yeah, we're playing around with different things. This doesn't work on the radio, Dave, but we're thinking of HQ 2 as in T-O-O. This is a really not a surprise based on reports over the past week, but it is a huge surprise based on obviously what Amazon originally proposed. Essentially, they have now and are going to have large centers in various locations around the country, 25,000 each in New York City and Washington, D.C., in terms of total number of employees. And Amazon is saying, at least, that this is all about talent. This will allow them to attract larger numbers of, you know, highly skilled engineers by tapping into two different pools of talent.
I'm curious to know what tax incentives they were offered, if any, in each of these two places. Do you know?
Yes. In fact, they are detailing those right now. In fact, we just posted on this. Just as an example, they say that Amazon will receive in Long Island City performance-based direct incentives of $1.5 billion. And so that gives you a sense for the scale. That's just one portion of the incentives. In Virginia, it's going to be approximately, roughly $573 million in addition to other incentives. So, you know, relatively large scale. We're talking hundreds of millions and more than $1 billion in incentives.
Wow. So performance-based. So essentially if they gain so many yards per game, they get the money, huh?
Yes, I assume that is measured in part by what they contribute to the economy, how many jobs they bring, and how quickly they expand in that location.
So are these areas welcoming Amazon? Or I was just reading some of the comments on the New York Times article, and there seemed to be an equal mix of go Amazon and, oh my gosh, these places will never be the same again.
Yes, it certainly does seem to be a very mixed reaction. I think the most savvy of these residents recognize what has happened in Seattle. The traffic, the housing prices, pricing out longtime residents. GeekWire's Monica Nicholsberg is in Arlington and has been talking with folks there and finding very much that same kind of reaction. A little bit of sarcasm in terms of what people actually expect to get from this. One person said he looks forward to the incoming gentrification.
The proximity of the Pentagon, that would seem to make sense because Amazon Web Services does a huge amount of government business, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does. And in fact, right now, there is a giant cloud computing contract up for grabs. Amazon and Microsoft are both competing for it, and it's going to be really fascinating to see if Amazon can leverage the fact that it's now essentially basing one of its now three headquarters, which it's very strange to say, but one of its now three headquarters right there next to the Pentagon.
And what is this new Nashville facility that I heard about?
Yeah, they're calling it an operations center of excellence, and we're still sorting through the meaning of this as well, but this clearly is something that was a big surprise and the type of thing that we'll see shake out. But essentially, it's in the thousands of employees, not nearly as large as we're going to be seeing in New York and Virginia, but obviously a major transportation hub there in Nashville and something that could play into Amazon's larger logistics growth.
Yeah. Okay, so big picture. Was this, in fact, all in reaction to the threat of a head tax in Seattle? Will they now do less building in Seattle than they would have otherwise? Will they siphon off some talent from Seattle and relocate it to get these new places started? Do you know?
Yes. In fact, I don't think this was an explicit reaction to the head tax. I think, though, the head tax reflected the overall undercurrent of animosity in Seattle toward Amazon, and that certainly played into this decision by Amazon. Clearly, they will now start focusing their growth in these other three cities. And I think that leases and new buildings that we've been seeing in Seattle over the past 3 years, I think a lot of that will start going elsewhere. So we will not see the growth at the same pace that we've seen here in Seattle. For me, one of the most fascinating things to watch is going to be the housing market. We've already seen a dip in home prices. What's going to happen here in Seattle as these Amazon employees and executives are given the option to go to one of these now other three places? That's the other quick thing here. You know, if it was just one place, it's a binary decision, Seattle or, you know, New York, for example.
Right.
But now that these employees have the option, I think it increases the chances you're going to see more people leave.
Right. Although, I mean, I've been to Washington, D.C. and New York. These are not cheap places to live.
They are not. And, you know, the median home price in Crystal City is already in the mid-600,000. So you're talking Seattle-esque type median home values there. So, yes, frankly, this would have been a much more interesting story journalistically if Amazon had picked more of an underdog, a Pittsburgh, the type of place where it could go in and really have a big economic development story. But clearly they saw a lot of talent in these three markets.
GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. Todd, thanks very much.
No problem, Dave.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Now, here he is from that overflowing grain elevator of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle. It's Danny O'Neill. And the latest viral video is this little tiff between one of the Rams and Justin Britt, where he took... Now, something had happened on the field between the two, right?
That's correct. Aaron Donald was returning what he thought was a fumble. Was later ruled to be an incomplete pass, and he got to the sideline, and he was a good two steps out of bounds, and Justin Britt blasted him as the good old shot from behind.
Late hit, yeah.
Aaron Donald took exception to it. In fact, it was such an egregious late hit that Aaron Donald felt compelled to respond, and it became a no-harm, no-foul situation because he got flagged, too, for trying to fight Justin Britt. So the foul's offset, which means nobody gets anything out of it. And after the game, Aaron Donald took off his shoulder pads and jersey, reaffixed his helmet, which was very, very smart, and set about going to find Justin Britt and grab his face mask and attempt to twist his head off.
Huh?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, he's mad. He's mad about what happened in the game.
What happens to him for doing that?
Well, we'll see. He might get fined.
Okay.
Maybe he'll lose some money. I found it to be... Here was the thing. One of the Seahawks linemen stepped in between him to kind of... And it was Jordan Simmons who had started his first game, and he didn't have his helmet on. We talked to him yesterday. I was like, next time, make sure your helmet's on.
Right.
Like, that could be a bad situation. But, yeah, it was – I thought Britt showed pretty good restraint because Donald clearly wanted to fight him. And Britt didn't fire on him, though I believe he told someone later he thought about just giving him a big gut punch.
There's squabbles in the NFL on the field, but they never get to the level of all-out brawls we see in MLB or in hockey. Is that because they're all padded up and wearing helmets and there's fines involved? Or why is that? Why don't we see more knockdown, drag-out fights?
It's a good question. I think part of it is because they're wearing helmets. Mm. So it's hard to... You're going to break your hand on the guy's helmet. Sure. The other part of it is that if you want to... Dave Wyman talks about this, taking a play off. And go get somebody, you can. And we just don't see that. But you're right. It's very rare to have an all-out brawl. There was a couple years ago in a game between a receiver, Michael Crabtree, and Aqib Talib. There have been examples of guys wanting to fight or trying to fight. But I would say ultimately the reason is because of the helmets. Sure. And that makes it hard to do. And the fact that you can get satisfaction other ways. Dave Wyman recalls and relishes a time where he saw offensive lineman Bart Oates, who had been giving him the business earlier in the game, and he saw an opportunity where Oates was kind of a little bit bent over, and Wyman just took his fist and like hit him on the back of the helmet and bounced his helmet off the turf. And Wyman said it was like a home run hitter where you just don't even feel it when his fist hit his helmet.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, you got to hear some of Wyman's stories. They're great.
Is he going to get fined for that now?
Well,
now that
retroactively?
Yeah.
No, the one time Wyman did get fined, though, was he hit Jeff Hostetler in his larynx. He was trying to block him. Yeah, and it was totally unintentional by Wyman, but yeah, he blocked him and he hit him in his larynx.
What do you know about this this allegation of racial prejudice against a member of the Mariners front office? This was a performance coach?
It's the head of what was their training staff. They hired Dr. Lorena Martin about a year ago to be their director and kind of oversee the medical staff as well as the trainers, as well as mental performance. And she's been fired. We learned yesterday she was fired about a month ago, and she has made via Instagram and her Twitter account an allegation that the Mariners top their farm director, who's a man named Andy McKay, Jerry DePoto, the GM, and their manager, Scott Service, have all said discriminatory, prejudiced things about Latino players and specifically
Dominicans.
The article
quoted a racial slur, and the Mariners have denied it.
But the Mariners have said it didn't happen. Yeah. And she's reiterated and now told the Tacoma News Tribune last night two different specific instances where she says it happens. The Mariners reiterated that there's no record of this. No complaint was filed to HR. She says she did note it with human resources. So now it gets to a point, as someone with a background as a reporter, you've got two irreconcilable versions of the truth. Somebody's lying here. I don't know how best to adjudicate that. What she says is completely inconsistent with anything I've ever heard. I've talked to all three, Andy McKay, Scott Service, Jerry DePoto. We interview Jerry DePoto each week. It seems incredibly out of character.
And this is on the heels, too, of the Mariners being pretty forthcoming about the sexual harassment and misconduct claims that were made against executives as well.
Correct. Acknowledging that there had been incidents, how those incidents were resolved, and in the case of the one executive who remained with the team, that he had gone to counseling to improve and understand how his actions affected people and how to treat people, specifically women who worked for him.
Danny O'Neill, our sports insider. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
In the Wall Street Journal, Hillary Clinton's former advisor, or as one critic put it, very former advisor, Mark Penn, wrote a piece saying that Hillary Clinton is, in fact, going to run for president in 2020. Let's consult with Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. I almost said former Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Farenthold from the Washington Post. Do you take this seriously?
Not one bit. This is Mark Penn, the pollster. This is him angling either for money for himself, just from other clients, or maybe he's trying to, you know, play the long, long odds of Hillary will want to get back into the game and hire him again. There's no way in hell that Hillary Clinton is going to get back into the presidential race. She lost last time. She hasn't shown any sign of wanting to get back into that race. It's not happening.
Yeah, and he doesn't quote her as saying that. So, all right, we'll call that a nothing burger and move on to my main question. Beto O'Rourke, is he running for 2020? Is he running in 2020? And since you're a Texan, tell me about. I guess I have failed to appreciate the attraction of Beto O'Rourke and certainly why he'd be considered for president.
Well, I think there's a good chance he will run for president, mostly because if he doesn't, what's he going to do now? He's out. He's lost his House seat. He's on another Senate race in Texas for another 2 years. He could run for mayor of El Paso or something, but there's not an obvious path up. And I think, like a lot of Democrats, without an obvious path up, he sees the presidency as a way, either maybe he'll win or maybe he'll just raise his profile so much that he'll find something new. You're going to see a lot of Democrats, especially Democrats from red states, running it that way. So what's the attraction of Beto O'Rourke? I think it's partly that Texas was changing, becoming much more blue, much more educated, much more urban, and they hadn't really ever had a good candidate to try to crystallize those people and bring them, to make them into a political force. He was that. Mm-hmm. Also, he just ran on kind of the Obama message of hope, bring everybody together, let's have a politics of love. You know, it didn't quite work, but people, it shows the power of that message in the era of Trump, where the Republican Party, at least on a national stage, is so dominated, and especially Ted Cruz, is so dominated by kind of politics of exclusion and sort of sneering.
So you think that the politics of love and reconciliation, because that's what Kyrsten Sinema alluded to in her race in Arizona, that we're going to bring people together, we're going to listen to each other without being, to understand, not to debate. You think that has an appeal in 2020?
Certainly. I mean, I think that the 2020 will be characterized by huge Democratic turnout from the Democratic base. The fight, and I think Arizona, you mentioned the Sinema race, I think that's a really good parallel of what the 2020 election will be like. The Democrats can win by winning over former Republicans, people in the middle who don't like Trump, but aren't willing to go far, far to the left. I think one of the things that did hurt Beto O'Rourke in Texas was that he, as he tried to win in this red state, He got a lot of enthusiasm from the base, but he didn't really reach out to Republicans or former Republicans in the middle with messages of kind of moderation, debate. He was pretty far to the left. He said, we should impeach Trump. We should talk about gun control. I think he actually, if he'd gone more to the middle, he might have had a chance to win.
So you think there's actually a market for moderates?
Yes. Look at who won, right? Look, Kristen Sinema won in Arizona. Last year in Virginia, Ralph Northam won. These are people who were Democrats, but they their message, in addition to whatever their policy message is, they have a sort of sentimental message of, you know, let's get together, let's have debate, let's sort of rebuild our democracy, let's reach out to each other. People want that.
I think I'm shocked. I'm shocked. I didn't think that Kumbaya would sell, that you would have to have somebody who is just as far to the populist left as Trump is on the populist right. So you think you think he's vulnerable in 2020?
Trump is, yes. I think, you know, he's the incumbent president. That's a huge advantage. We've seen from this election that he has a surprising amount of strength in places like Florida, where the race is very, very, very close. Places like Ohio, Missouri, places that had been thought of as swing states now are pretty red. But, you know, this was Trump's side with full employment, a zooming economy, and they got crushed in a lot of places and only barely won in Florida, which is the one swing state where they really won. So I think he is vulnerable. You have to remember back in 2016, Trump was disliked, but Hillary Clinton was also massively disliked. Mm-hmm. And people who disliked both of them voted disproportionately for Trump. If the Democrats can manage to nominate someone who's not historically disliked, I think they have a great chance. And that begins with somebody who can sort of reach out to the middle.
That's why you're pretty sure Hillary is not going to run. One more thing. The Jim Acosta incident, being exiled from the White House, CNN is filing suit, saying he has a First Amendment right to be there. Do you have a First Amendment right to a White House press pass?
This is a really interesting question. Obviously, it's terrible that the White House has excluded Jim Acosta, and they should not have done that. It's an insult to the free press. It's an insult to the Americans who use the free press to become informed about the White House. The suit, though, turns on an issue of security. What Acosta is asking for is a hard pass, which is like a sort of the lingo for a permanent pass to go in and out. There's less scrutiny of you every day because you're sort of on the cleared list.
Yeah.
You know, he's saying that he has a First Amendment right to that, not just to ask the president questions, but to this specific kind of security clearance within the White House. And I don't know how a judge is going to look at that. And if a judge decides that he doesn't have a right to that, that there's no automatic right to a hard pass, then I think his lawsuit will end up empowering the White House more to exclude people they don't like. So I'm a little worried about the kind of law this would make. But, you know, CNN's decided this is the law and the right are on their side. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter David Fahrenthold. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Stan Lee, who, judging by his output, has to be one of the most creative human minds in history, has passed away at the age of 95. And Dyer Oxley is here from MyNorthwest.com. He hosts the award-winning Northwest Nerd podcast. I was a strictly DC Comics kid, so it was, you know, Superman, Batman. I never... For some reason, the Marvel Universe was just foreign to me. But explain Stan Lee's contribution, what made him so special.
You know, I was a lot like you. Superman was my guy. And I came up in the 90s when Superman died, so that was huge.
Yeah.
However, the way I like to describe Stan Lee and why he was so important, even for folks who might not have been as into him, is imagine the computer world, our world of smartphones and computers that are right in front of us right now in the studio without Bill Gates or without Steve Jobs. They didn't invent computers, but they put them in our lives in a way that never existed before, that was so monumental in its influence, and that was Stan Lee to comic books. I mean, it seems a little bit far off to think of it right now, but back in the early 60s, mid-50s, there was this thing called the Comics Code of Authority, and it really kind of pacified comic books in a way.
Right.
And Stan Lee ran right against the grain with that. And his characters didn't adhere to that code. Sometimes they took that little marker of the code off the comic books because in this edition, Stan Lee gave one of his characters a drug addiction. And that was just so far out of the realm of possibility with comic books right then. Superheroes were supposed to have, you know, cleft chins and speak like this and, you know, punch the bad guys.
Well, James, our producer, was explaining to me that there were – it was intentional. He was trying to basically preach in some of these in some of these comic books.
He said that he would never really pound you over the head with it, but it was quite clear what he was doing. And he came up as editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. At the time when he came in, it was called Timely, but they converted it to Marvel and took on DC, the big powerhouse at the time. He was never going to be straightforward with it, but there was these very, very clear metaphors, much in the same way that we look at Star Trek today. Yeah, X-Men was quite clearly a metaphor for the civil rights movement that was happening for its time. Spider-Man, which was never supposed to happen, he snuck it in at the last minute, was also a metaphor for what a lot of teenagers are going through. There was a lot of drug addiction, like I said, in that one in the early early issues.
And he was a big champion of recognizing differences and celebrating those,
right,
not holding them against the people. So in a way, his message was about kindness, it was about equality, mm-hmm, and acceptance, which was huge.
It's funny that you say that, because over the last, especially over the last day after his death, but over the last year or so, what has been recirculating around the internet, around Twitter, are these little columns that he used to write called Stanley's Soapbox. Mm. And back in the day, these comic books and these magazines used to have little one-page news items, what would come in the comic books. And as editor, he would write an opinion article. It was just a small column. And a lot of them had to do with racism and bigotry. One of the ones he did that's been going around lately had to do with love and what characters in our history of Christ and Buddha and Moses, they last. But then you look at the people whose acts were hateful and they don't. And that was his, that was kind of his, when he really did get on his, you know, soapbox, it was Stan's soapbox. One of the things that I pulled out more recently is he said bigotry and racism are among the deadliest social ills plaguing the world. And he said that right after Martin Luther King was assassinated. Further saying that humanity would never really realize its destiny if we kept doing this to each other. And he was saying this in the 60s.
So who takes his place now?
There's a few people in the comic book realm that we could probably point to. It, personally, with my bias, again, with Superman, I think Brian Michael Bendis, who's a Northwest comic book creator out of Portland, who has now taken the helm of Superman, is probably one of the guys that I think is going to push this forward. Of course, I think a lot of comic book fans are going to tell you that it's going to be found in a lot of the indies that are coming up and doing it their own way and going against the grain, just as Stan did it. But if we're looking at just the big powerhouses, Brian Michael Bendis just led Marvel through right up until where we had this Marvel Cinematic Universe that has now taken over Hollywood.
Yeah.
And he has moved over to DC, and now we're going to look at what he just did with Marvel, post-Stan Lee. He's going to probably be doing it with DC. So all eyes are on Superman right now, because that's what he's helming.
Dyer Oxley, who hosts the Northwest Nerd podcast at mynorthwest.com. Thanks, Dyer.
Thank you.